Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're doing a deep dive into something pretty hefty. It's called Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. This document's basically a blueprint for what a conservative presidential administration might look like, you know, if they get in the future.
Yeah.
And it's pretty packed with specific plans.
Well, yeah.
You really get into the weeds about how they want to change up almost every single, I think every government agency out there.
Yeah, it is. It's remarkably detailed. It goes way beyond your typical policy talk, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about potential actions, how they'd actually reorganize things.
Right.
Pretty interesting stuff.
Now, we're not here to like endorse any political stance or anything like that. Really, our goal today is to help you, the listener, understand the most insightful and fascinating pieces of this document, kind of like a cheat sheet to a pretty complex political strategy.
Exactly. We want to give you, the listener, the knowledge you need so you can understand what the impact of these proposals could actually be, you know, without having to read through hundreds of pages yourself.
Right, because it's a long document.
Yeah.
And it's got a pretty interesting history, too, doesn't it?
It does. The original Mandate for Leadership was published way back in 1981, actually.
Oh, wow.
During the Reagan presidency.
Okay.
And get this, over 60% of their recommendations actually became policy.
Really? 60%? That's a lot.
It is. So this new version, it's building on that legacy, you know?
But they're kind of aiming to do the same thing, but for today, for a new era.
Yeah, that's the goal. But obviously, the political landscape is very different from back in the 80s.
Of course, yeah.
So the authors here, they see America in a state of decline. And they're proposing this as a roadmap to, and I'm quoting here, rescue kids, reclaim culture, revive the economy, and defeat the anti-American left.
Oh, wow. That's some pretty strong language.
Yeah.
One of the core themes I noticed right away was this idea of using federal power to actually support the traditional nuclear family. I mean, at first it sounds kind of like a typical conservative idea, but
yeah.
Is there more to it than that?
It does go a bit beyond the typical talking points, yeah. They're actually suggesting government intervention in things like the tax code. To, you know, to actively encourage people to form families and even, get this, to reinforce parental authority.
Wow.
A very interesting approach, you know, one that could have some big implications for how families are treated by the government going forward.
Yeah, that's definitely something to keep an eye on. Now, one thing that really intrigued me was all the detail they went into about actually restructuring the White House itself. They seem really focused on maximizing the president's impact through strategically placed personnel.
Yeah, they propose creating a deputy chief of staff position that focuses specifically on social and economic policy.
Okay.
And this person would be a key player in making sure the president's agenda gets implemented, you know, working closely with the chief of staff, coordinating with cabinet members.
It makes you wonder how that might change things within the administration, you know? Would it create like a more centralized approach to decision making, maybe?
That's a good question. It certainly seems like they're leaning towards a White House where the power is concentrated at the top,
mm-hmm.
with these key advisors playing a really crucial role in driving the agenda.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then they also really emphasize the need for a White House counsel who is totally on board with the president's vision, almost like a proactive defender of the agenda, not just, you know, reacting to legal issues as they come up.
Absolutely. It's not just about legal expertise. It's about having someone who can really anticipate the challenges and aggressively defend the president's actions.
Huh. It makes you think about the implications for checks and balances within the administration.
For sure.
Then there's the Office of Public Liaison, the OPL.
Mm.
They want to give it even more power, essentially making it the gatekeeper for interest groups, right?
That's a big change. I mean, the OPL would have a lot of influence over who gets to see the president, potentially even shaping, you know, the flow of information and lobbying efforts that make it to the White House.
It sounds like they're really trying to control the narrative and kind of limit outside influence. But wouldn't that potentially make the administration less transparent, you know?
That's a valid concern, yeah. Critics might say that, you know, concentrating so much power within the White House could lead to less accountability,
mm-hmm.
and more potential for decisions being made behind closed doors.
Right, right. It's a tough balance for sure. Now let's talk about how they're tackling the budget. They seem to be really advocating for giving the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, a lot more power to, like, enforce the president's priorities at the agency level.
They do. They even propose dividing up some of the existing OMB divisions.
Okay.
You know, for more targeted oversight. It's like a more specialized and maybe even a more assertive approach to managing the budget.
It's like creating an army of budget hawks, basically. Mm-hmm. to make sure every dollar is spent according to the president's vision. And then there's their proposal to bring back something called administrative PAYGO, pay as you go.
Yeah, PAYGO. It basically means that any new spending has to be offset by cuts somewhere else. So, you know, essentially enforcing budget neutrality.
So it's like you can't spend money unless you cut something else.
Right. It could potentially lead to a more balanced budget, but it could also make it harder to fund new programs or expand the existing ones.
Yeah, it sounds like it could lead to some really tough choices and potential pushback from, you know, different agencies that are all vying for funding. And they're not stopping there. They also want to make some changes to the National Security Council.
Yeah, the NSC.
Suggesting it should have its own independent council.
That's a pretty big change from how things work now. Could definitely have a big impact on how national security decisions are made.
Right, right.
On the one hand, it could streamline the process, maybe even lead to quicker action on critical issues, you know. But it also raises concerns about, you know, potential conflicts with the White House counsel and maybe a lack of coordination.
It's almost like they're trying to create like a separate power center within the White House, specifically focused on national security.
That's an interesting way to look at it. It definitely highlights how much emphasis they're putting on national security and maybe streamlining those decisions.
No, yeah. And speaking of prioritizing national security, this document does not hold back when it comes to taking on China. They even use the term economic warfare.
Yeah, countering China's economic and geopolitical influence is a huge theme throughout this whole document.
Okay.
They are advocating for a much more assertive stance, suggesting policies that, frankly, could really reshape the whole U.S.-China relationship.
Like, for example, they propose really digging into and maybe even rejecting any climate change assessments that were, you know, put together under the Biden administration. That's a pretty clear sign of their intent to kind of shift direction on environmental policy.
Yeah, big time. It really signals a potential return to a more, you know, America first approach, where economic interests and national security concerns are really taking precedence over, you know, international cooperation on climate change.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, especially on the global stage.
Yeah.
Now, they're also calling for a major overhaul of the civil service, focusing on, you know, merit-based hiring and performance-based retention.
Huge change, potentially. I mean, that could have far-reaching consequences for the entire federal workforce.
Right.
You know, people who support it say it would create a more efficient, more accountable government. But critics worry it could lead to, you know, politicization of the civil service and make it harder to recruit and keep qualified people.
Yeah, that's a good point. They seem particularly focused on restoring the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, to its, you know, original function, which was overseeing merit-based hiring. They even say that getting rid of the professional and administrative career examination, the PACE e-exam, they say that was a mistake.
They do. They argue that PACE was a good, reliable tool for choosing qualified candidates and that, you know, getting rid of it has led to a decline in the quality of the federal workforce. They essentially want to go back to a system that emphasizes, you know, what you know and how well you do your job rather than these other factors.
So it sounds like they're aiming for a pretty significant reshuffling of how the federal government operates, from, you know, how they hire people to how they do the budget. But it's not just about internal changes, is it? I mean, their proposals for dealing with China and reforming the civil service, it seems to suggest a bigger shift in how the U.S. interacts with the rest of the world.
That's a really good observation. It seems like they're pushing for a more assertive and maybe even confrontational approach to global affairs, putting American interests and values first, you know, above all else.
And this is just the beginning. We haven't even gotten to their plans for the Defense Department, Homeland Security, and so much more. It seems like they really want to, you know, leave no stone unturned.
They really don't. Mandate for Leadership is it's a bold document, lays out a very specific vision for what a conservative administration would look like.
It's a vision that's it's definitely going to spark a lot of debate and raise some really important questions about where the country is headed. We'll continue our deep dive into this document in our next episode, and we'll be exploring their proposals for national security, foreign policy, and a lot more.
So, you know, speaking of a more assertive approach, let's get into what Mandate for Leadership has to say about the Defense Department. They definitely don't mince words here. They're calling for a substantial increase in defense spending. And it's very clear they're focused on China as the main threat.
Substantial increase, huh? How substantial are we talking?
Well, it's significantly higher than what the current administration has budgeted for. I mean, we're talking the biggest increase in defense spending in over a decade, probably. You know, this is definitely going to bring back that whole debate about military spending versus, you know, social programs. Those who are pushing for more spending on social programs, they might see this as the wrong way to use those resources.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It would be interesting to see how they think they can balance those competing priorities, because they're both important, right?
Yeah.
Now the document doesn't just, you know, stop at increasing the overall budget. It gets in some very specific recommendations too, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. One of the most striking ones, I think, is this idea of actually strengthening and expanding the U.S. nuclear arsenal.
Huh.
That's a pretty big change from, you know, the current administration, which has been trying to reduce the role of nuclear weapons. And it raises some, you know, some serious questions about the risks, maybe, of escalating things globally, you know, maybe even a new arms race.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be controversial. What else do they have in mind for the Defense Department?
Well, they also recommend that all high school students in schools that get federal funding, that they would have to take the ESVAP.
The military entrance exam.
That's the one, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Mandatory ESVABs for everyone. That's a big change.
It is. Their argument is that this would, you know, help identify students who are qualified and maybe interested in joining the military, which could, you know, boost recruitment. But of course, some people might see it as a way of, you know, kind of pressuring young people to think about the military even before they've, you know, really thought about other career options.
Yeah, it definitely raises those questions about, you know, individual choice, whether this is kind of a subtle form of coercion. Maybe.
Right.
And it's not the only controversial proposal there. They also want to get rid of the exceptions for people with, you know, pre-existing medical conditions or gender dysphoria when it comes to serving in the military.
Yeah, that's another one that's likely to get some pushback for sure. It sort of signals a shift back to a more traditional view of, you know, what it means to be, quote unquote, fit for service.
Yeah.
And it does raise concerns about potential discrimination against people who could otherwise serve their country, you know, effectively.
Right. It's like they're trying to redefine what fit for service even means. Now, beyond, you know, the personnel side of things, they also talk about more traditional military capabilities. Like they call for expanding those regional missile defense systems and really strengthening our cyber defenses.
Yeah, those are areas that are already getting a lot of attention within the Department of Defense. But this document, it really emphasizes that we need to prioritize them even more, especially with this growing threat from China. It's pretty clear they see these capabilities as absolutely essential, you know, to deter aggression and maintain that U.S. military dominance.
So basically, it sounds like a pretty hawkish approach to defense policy overall, really focused on building up that U.S. military power and preparing for, you know, potential conflict, especially with China.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. And that emphasis on confrontation, you see it in their proposals for homeland security as well. They're calling for a pretty major overhaul of DHS with a big focus on strictly enforcing immigration laws and much tighter border control.
Right, which, you know, fits with their overall theme of national security being the top priority. But what does that actually look like in practice? Like what specific changes are they talking about making?
Well, one of their key proposals is to soft close, as they put it, any DHS offices that they deem ineffective and shift all those resources to what they call mission critical components. So basically, they want to streamline the agency, you know, focus on its core functions that relate to national security, which, you know, could mean cutting programs that they see as wasteful or unnecessary.
Yeah, it sounds, you know, efficient on the surface, but wouldn't that risk, you know, losing some valuable expertise maybe, or creating gaps in how services are delivered? I mean, some people might argue that certain programs, even if they don't, you know, directly relate to national security, are still really important for people, for communities.
That's a good point. It's that classic tension, right, between efficiency and the risk of, you know, unintended consequences.
Right, right.
And their approach to border security is especially noteworthy, I think. They want to mandate that IC use all of its detention space. And and basically eliminate the use of those alternatives to detention, the ATDs, for people crossing the border, except in very rare cases.
Okay, that seems like a pretty big shift from how things are done now. What would be the impact of a policy like that?
Well, you know, ATDs are often used as a more humane and cost-effective alternative to actually detaining people. You know, it allows individuals to stay in their communities while they're, you know, waiting for their immigration proceedings. So getting rid of them would likely lead to a lot more people being held in detention, which could, you know, overwhelm the system and raise concerns about human rights violations potentially.
Yeah, it sounds very controversial for sure. Are there any other changes they want to implement when it comes to immigration and border control?
Yeah, they also call for a total ban on catch and release policies, and they want to expand the use of expedited removal, which means, you know, faster deportations, essentially, with less due process. It's definitely a much more hardline approach than what the current administration has been doing, which has been, you know, focused more on trying to find ways for undocumented immigrants to become citizens.
So we're seeing a clear pattern here. When it comes to both defense and homeland security, their approach is really all about, you know, strength, control, and taking a more assertive stance towards anything they see as a threat, whether it's, you know, coming from abroad or from within the U.S.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that emphasis on control, you see it extending to their proposals for the intelligence community as well.
ICC, right.
Yeah, the IC, they're calling for a strong and empowered IC. They want to see more aggressive use of intelligence authorities to counter adversaries like, you know, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, the usual suspects.
So basically giving the IC more freedom to gather intelligence and conduct operations, you know, even covert ones potentially, with less oversight.
Well, they don't explicitly say less oversight, but they do recommend giving the Director of National Intelligence, the DNI, more control over the IC's budget and who they appoint to positions, which, you know, some people might interpret as a move towards giving the executive branch more power over intelligence gathering and analysis.
Right. And it does raise concerns about, you know, potential abuses of power, whether these increased authorities could be used to, you know, to target political opponents within the U.S.
Yeah.
Or to try to suppress dissent.
Yeah, those are definitely valid concerns. It's always a tough balance to strike, right, between national security and civil liberties.
Mm.
And this document seems to lean pretty heavily towards national security.
Yeah. And they also seem pretty intent on reforming the CIA, saying that its activities need to be more closely aligned with the president's goals and what the State Department is doing.
Right. They want to avoid what they see as rogue operations, essentially. Make sure that everyone's, you know, on the same page when it comes to foreign policy objectives. It's about centralizing control and minimizing the potential for these agencies to act independently, I guess.
Yeah, it sounds like they're pushing for a much more, you know, hierarchical and tightly controlled intelligence apparatus, with the president really at the top calling the shots. And their recommendations for media agencies, especially the U.S. Agency for Global Media, the USAGM, it seems to follow a similar pattern, that control and centralization.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They're calling for some big reforms to the USAGM. They cite security concerns,
right,
you know, the potential for foreign influence. They want to address what they see as vulnerabilities within the agency and really make sure everyone's following the security protocols,
mm-hmm,
you know, really focusing on preventing leaks and foreign interference.
So essentially cracking down on any information or messaging that they see as harmful to national security or maybe just contrary to the administration's agenda.
That's one way to interpret it. Yeah. They also want to restructure the agency's leadership, you know, to make sure it's aligned with U.S. interests. It's about making sure that the USAGM is promoting American values and foreign policy objectives as defined by the administration, of course.
Right. Right. Doesn't sound like they're big fans of the USAGM's current, you know, editorial direction.
No, they definitely see it as problematic. They suggest that it might be, you know, susceptible to bias or even foreign manipulation. And they also advocate for, you know, really thoroughly vetting all of the USAGM employees and contractors to identify any potential security risks, which, you know, some people might see as an attempt to root out dissent or any alternative viewpoints.
It seems like their approach to media and information control really mirrors their overall strategy. You know, that centralization and control, making sure that the message that's getting out there is the one that aligns with their vision for America's role in the world.
Exactly. And this brings us to their proposals for foreign aid, specifically the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. They want to see a pretty big shift away from the traditional aid models, and they're advocating for something that's more targeted and more driven by ideology.
Okay, so what would that actually look like?
Well, they want to focus on what they call holistic healthcare, which includes support for unborn children. And they propose a request for application for resilient families to really prioritize family well-being. It's pretty clear that they want to bring their social conservative values into U.S. foreign aid.
It makes you wonder if that would, politicize aid and whether we really align with the needs and priorities of the countries that are receiving that aid.
Yeah, those are valid concerns. They also want to reform USAID's Democracy, Human Rights, and Governance Center. They say it's been funding programs that are too politically charged.
So less emphasis on promoting democracy and human rights abroad.
Yeah, they say those programs haven't been effective, and that U.S. foreign aid should focus more on practical goals like promoting economic growth and stability. But, critics might see this as a step back from America's commitment to promoting democratic values around the world.
It's definitely a shift in focus, for sure, and one that could have, some implications for how the U.S. is seen globally. Now, they also talk about strengthening regional alliances in the Middle East, building on those Abraham Accords to try to counter Iran's influence.
Yeah, they see the Abraham Accords as a big foreign policy win, and they want to, build on that to try to create a more stable and pro-U.S. Middle East. It really fits with their overall strategy of forming these strategic alliances to counter what they see as threats and to advance American interests.
So it's a pretty complex approach to foreign aid, driven by, a mix of strategic thinking and a desire to promote their particular social values. And speaking of social values, their proposals for the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, they're pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of revealing their broader agenda.
Yeah, they're calling for a major overhaul of HHS to align it with their conservative social values. It's probably one of the most controversial sections of the whole document, to be honest, because it touches on some of the most, hotly debated issues in American society today.
Yeah, let's unpack that a little bit. What specifically are they proposing for HHS?
Well, One of the most surprising proposals, I think, is to end what they call the quote unquote incestuous relationship between the NIH, the CDC, and vaccine makers.
Wow, that's pretty strong language. What's the thinking there?
They argue that this close relationship has led to conflicts of interest and a lack of transparency in how vaccines are developed and approved. It seems like they're tapping into that existing public distrust of these institutions, especially after everything that happened with the pandemic.
Yeah, so it's about shaking up the pharmaceutical industry and maybe changing how vaccines are regulated, which, that would have a huge impact on public health policy.
Oh, absolutely. And their most controversial proposal, in this section at least, is probably their call to stop the FDA from approving those chemical abortion drugs, which would essentially ban medication abortion at the federal level.
Wow. Okay. That's a major policy change and one that would have immediate and far-reaching consequences for women's reproductive rights. It would almost certainly face legal challenges and just reignite the whole debate over abortion access.
Yeah, there's no question it would be a major flashpoint in the culture wars. They also want to strengthen those conscience protections for healthcare providers. So, allowing them to refuse to provide certain services like abortion based on their religious or moral beliefs.
Right. Which again highlights that focus on promoting their specific social values through government policy, and they're not stopping there. Yeah. They also want to refocus HHS programs to actively encourage marriage, work, and those traditional nuclear families.
It's all about promoting their vision of what the ideal American family should look like, and doing that through government programs and policies,
mm-hmm.
which could mean, you know, shifting resources away from programs that support single parents or different types of family structures.
So it seems like their approach to HHS is really all about aligning the department with their conservative social agenda, prioritizing their values, maybe over individual choice,
yeah.
and potentially even restricting access to some healthcare services.
Yeah, it's a bold approach, that's for sure, and one that would have, you know, big consequences for healthcare and social welfare programs, especially for people who don't fit their very narrow definition of what an American family should be.
And this idea of reshaping government institutions to fit their vision, it extends to the Department of Agriculture too, the USDA. They're calling for a USDA that really empowers farmers and reduces the amount of government intervention in the food system.
Right. They want to move away from what they call the Biden administration's quote unquote centrally planned transformational effort when it comes to agriculture. And instead they want to, you know, take a more market driven approach, prioritize efficiency and production over what they see as too much regulation.
So it's about giving farmers more freedom to run their businesses with less oversight.
Yeah.
And potentially scaling back those environmental regulations.
Yeah, exactly. They specifically say they want to reform the Conservation Reserve Program to allow farmers to use land that's currently, you know, voluntarily set aside for conservation.
So basically putting more land back into production,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, they argue would increase how much food we're producing and bring prices down. But wouldn't that also have, you know, negative impacts on the environment? I mean, some people would say that conserving land is really important, you know, for protecting biodiversity and trying to do something about climate change.
Yeah, those are definitely valid concerns. It's that age-old debate, right, between economic interests and environmental protection. And this document, it definitely puts economic growth first. They also want to reform those USDA conservation easements. They want to prevent what they call perpetual enforcement and give future generations more flexibility in how they manage their land.
So they're worried that these easements are restricting property rights and limiting, you know, the economic opportunities for landowners.
Yeah, they want to make sure that landowners have more control over their property and that conservation efforts don't end up stifling economic development. But, you know, critics would probably say that this could undermine those efforts to protect, you know, valuable natural resources for future generations.
Yeah, it's a really complicated issue. No easy answers there. And it seems like this theme of reducing government control and empowering individuals, it carries over to their proposals for the Department of Education as well, which they want to really shake things up, restructure the whole thing.
Yeah, they're calling for a pretty big shift away from federal control over education. They're pushing policies that give parents more power and that promote school choice. It's a core part of, you know, that conservative education agenda, really focusing on giving parents more say over their kids' education.
So what kind of specific changes are they actually proposing?
Well, one of the key ones is this idea of advancing education freedom, as they call it. They want to do that through portability of federal funding and tax credits for those K-12 education savings accounts, which, you know, would basically allow parents to use public funds to pay for private school tuition or other, you know, educational expenses, which, you know, could potentially take money away from public schools.
Yeah, that's definitely a controversial one. It would have a big impact on how public schools are funded. And it could, you know, it could make those inequalities between public and private schools even worse.
Right. It's a debate that's been going on for decades. And this document, it clearly sides with those who want more school choice and less government involvement in education. They also want to get rid of a bunch of Biden administration regulations, you know, things on charter schools, civil rights data collection, student loans, Title IX, all sorts of things. They argue that those regulations are just creating too much of a burden for schools and that they're interfering with the rights of parents.
So a pretty big rollback of federal oversight in education, really driven by by this belief in limited government and parental control.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't stop there. They want to strengthen the legal protections for parental rights in education. Make sure that those rights are treated as equal to other fundamental rights, which, you know, would give parents more power to challenge school policies and curriculum that they don't agree with, and that could lead to more lawsuits and more conflict within school districts.
It seems like they're trying to really shift who has the power in education, giving more to parents and maybe diminishing the role of educators and school boards.
I think that's a fair way to put it. They also want to use those federally overseen school systems, you know, the ones in Washington, D.C., on military bases and on tribal lands. They want to turn those into models of school choice, basically using them as testing grounds for their vision of a more market-driven education system.
It's a bold vision, one that would have, you know, some really big consequences for American education. Be interesting to see how it would actually work in practice, though, and whether it would, you know, actually lead to better outcomes for all students.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And speaking of bold visions, their proposals for the Department of Energy are just as ambitious. They're calling for a pretty major shift in energy policy towards American energy independence and reducing how much we rely on renewable energy sources.
Wow. That's a pretty big contrast with the current administration's focus on clean energy and climate change. What's the reasoning behind that shift?
Well, they argue that the Biden administration's approach is too focused on, you know, what they call centrally planned solutions, and that it's holding back American energy production. They want to unleash the power of the free market, as they put it, and prioritize those traditional energy sources like oil, gas, and coal.
So it's that classic debate, right, between government intervention and free market principles. And this document is clearly on the side of the free market. So what specific changes do they actually want to implement?
Well, they propose refocusing those national labs on more fundamental and advanced science and leaving the development of new technology to the private sector. So they seem to think that the government should focus on, you know, that basic research and then let private companies be the ones to actually develop and commercialize new energy technologies.
So it's kind of a shift in priorities.
Yeah.
That would probably lead to less government funding for clean energy research and development.
Yeah.
Which, you know, some people would say could slow down progress in those areas.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern for those who think that the government has a really important role to play in fostering clean energy innovation.
Mm-hmm.
They also want to reform the Department of Energy's approach to nuclear waste disposal.
Okay.
And increase the role of the private sector there.
So less government involvement in managing nuclear waste. Which, you know, could open up opportunities for private companies to make money from disposing of it.
Yeah.
But wouldn't that also raise, you know, some concerns about safety and accountability?
Yeah, that's a legitimate concern. You know, critics would probably say that private companies are going to put profit ahead of safety, and that the government really has a responsibility to make sure that nuclear waste is disposed of, you know, safely and responsibly.
Right. It's a tough issue with potential risks and rewards, I guess. Mm-hmm. What other changes do they have in mind for the Energy Department?
Well, they also want to eliminate or at least reduce funding for the DOE's applied energy programs, including those in the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, the ER.
So that's a pretty big cut to clean energy programs.
Yeah.
Yeah, a clear signal that they want to shift those resources away from renewables and back towards those more traditional energy sources.
Yeah, their argument is that these programs are just wasteful and that the market should decide which energy sources get developed. But, you know, critics would say that government support is really important for helping those clean energy industries grow and to make that transition to a more sustainable energy future.
Yeah, it's a debate that's not going away anytime soon. What about energy markets and regulation? Do they have any proposals for those areas?
Yeah, they want to get rid of what they see as market distortions that are caused by government subsidies for clean energy projects. So basically they want to let market forces decide how energy resources are allocated.
So a more hands-off approach to energy policy.
Yeah.
with less government intervention and more reliance on private investment.
Exactly. They also want to make sure that those reliable and dispatchable energy sources like coal and natural gas, that they're properly valued within those regional transmission organizations, the RTOs. You know, the RTOs are the ones that manage the flow of electricity across large areas. And their argument is that the current regulations kind of disadvantage those traditional energy sources in favor of renewables.
So it sounds like they're trying to, you know, level the playing field
yeah.
and to make sure that those traditional energy sources can still compete even as renewables are, you know, becoming more popular.
That's their goal, yeah. They also want to reform the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. They want to make it prioritize the affordability and reliability of natural gas and to make it easier to get pipelines approved. You know, FERC is the one that regulates the interstate transmission of electricity and natural gas and oil. And they really want to make it easier to build that new natural gas infrastructure.
So it's a pretty comprehensive approach to energy policy, one that aims to shift things in favor of those traditional energy sources, reduce the amount of regulation and increase American energy independence.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And that preference for less regulation and more power for industry, you see it in their proposals for the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA as well. They're pushing for a pretty big shift in environmental policy, going back to what they call a back to basics approach and really reducing how much power the EPA has to regulate things.
Right. Which, you know, that's consistent with their views on other agencies. But what does that actually mean for environmental protection?
Well, they argue that the EPA has just become too bureaucratic, you know, too much of a burden for businesses, and that it's stifling economic growth. They want to streamline the agency structure, make it easier for businesses to comply with environmental regulations. But, you know, critics would say that this would just weaken those environmental protections and make it harder for the EPA to actually enforce those environmental laws.
So it's that classic debate again, right, between economic growth and protecting the environment. And this document is clearly prioritizing economic growth. So what are some of the specific changes they want to make to the EPA?
Well, they propose eliminating any EPA research and development activities that aren't specifically authorized by Congress. You know, they say that the EPA should stick to its core mission of regulation and not
be doing research that goes beyond that.
Right.
Which, you know, suggests that they're kind of skeptical of the EPA's role in scientific research, especially when it comes to things like climate change.
Yeah, it seems like it. They also want to change how those EPA advisory committees are put together to make sure that there's, you know, what they call balanced representation and to prevent what they see as political bias.
OK, so that sounds like a response to those concerns that the EPA's advisory committees have been, you know, mostly made up of environmental activists and haven't really given enough weight to industry perspective.
Yeah, exactly. They want to make sure that businesses and industries have a voice in how the EPA makes decisions and that the economic impact of those regulations is taken into consideration. But of course, critics would argue that this would just give too much influence to those industries, you know, the ones that prioritize profit over protecting the environment.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, whose voices are being heard and whose interests are really being put first. What other changes are they proposing for the EPA?
Well, they also want to change how the EPA approaches science. They want them to be more transparent about the data they use, make sure that it's, you know, reproducible. They argue that the EPA has been using, you know, what they call flawed science to justify its regulations.
Right, which is, you know, a claim that you hear a lot from people who are against environmental regulations.
Yeah. They say that the EPA needs to be much more open about, you know, how it comes to its conclusions and that those conclusions should be, you know, something that other researchers can verify independently. It really reflects this broader distrust of government science and this desire to make sure that any regulations are based on solid, you know, scientific evidence.
Yeah, it's a debate that's, you know, probably going to keep going, especially when it comes to those really politically charged issues like climate change. And finally, let's talk about their proposals for the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC. It seems like they see that as needing some pretty big changes as well.
Yeah, they're really focused on trying to curb the power of those big tech companies and to rethink how antitrust laws are enforced. You know, it's an issue that's been getting a lot of attention lately with all the concerns about, you know, those tech giants like Google, Facebook, Amazon, and how much power they have.
Right. So what are their specific concerns about big tech, and when what are they proposing to do about it?
Well, one of their main concerns is that they think big tech is censoring conservative viewpoints. So they want to limit how much power these companies have to censor speech, you know, even protected speech. And they even suggest that maybe, you know, Section 230 immunity should be taken away from platforms that engage in what they consider to be censorship.
Okay, and for those who don't know, Section 230 is that really important legal protection for tech companies. It basically shields them from being sued for content that's posted by their users. So getting rid of it would be a huge deal. It would completely change how these platforms operate and could open them up to a ton of lawsuits.
Oh, absolutely. It's a really controversial idea, and the tech industry is very much against it. They argue that Section 230 is crucial for protecting free speech online, and that getting rid of it would lead to a lot more censorship, not less.
Yeah, it's a really tricky issue trying to balance that free speech with the need to do something about, you know, the harmful content that's out there. What other proposals do they have when it comes to the FTC?
Well, they also say that TikTok should be banned because of, you know, national security concerns. They point to the fact that it's owned by a Chinese company,
Well, yeah.
and they worry about the potential for data collection and influence operations.
Right, and that's an idea that's been gaining some traction lately with all those concerns about, you know, China's growing influence and whether they might be able to get access to user data through TikTok.
Yeah, definitely. They also want to stop US businesses from helping China develop artificial intelligence. They're worried that could give China a strategic advantage in those emerging technologies.
So it seems like they're taking a very, very adversarial stance towards China, really seeing it as a major threat, both economically and to national security.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They even go so far as to suggest that maybe the FTC shouldn't even exist anymore, that maybe all of that antitrust enforcement should just be handled by the Department of Justice.
Wow. Okay, that's a pretty radical idea. It would basically eliminate the FTC as an independent agency, which, you know, suggests that they think it's become too powerful or ineffective, maybe.
Yeah, they argue that the FTC has been too focused on protecting consumers and not enough on promoting competition. So it sounds like they'd prefer a much more hands-off approach to antitrust enforcement.
So we've covered a lot of ground here today, from, you know, defense and homeland security to foreign aid and the tech industry. It's clear that this document, this mandate for leadership, lays out a really detailed, comprehensive vision for what a future conservative administration might look like.
It does. It's a vision that seeks to really reshape those government institutions, to prioritize certain social values, and to take a much more assertive, you know, America first approach on the world stage.
And it's definitely a vision that's going to generate a lot of debate, a lot of controversy. So in our next episode, we're going to explore some of the potential implications of these proposals, thinking about what impact they might have on American society and on the US's role in the world. But for now, I want to thank you, expert speaker, for joining us today and for sharing your expertise and insights. You've really helped us to understand this complex and controversial document.
My pleasure. It's been a great discussion.
And to our listeners, we encourage you to check out Mandate for Leadership for yourselves if you're interested in learning more. It's a really fascinating read, whether you know, agree with what it says or not. It gives you a glimpse into a particular worldview and how some people think America should deal with the challenges of the 21st century. And as you go about your day, think about how those proposals that we talked about today might affect you, your community, the things you care about. How would a government that follows this vision, how would that shape the future of our country? What kind of opportunities would it create? What kind of challenges? These are questions worth thinking about, and we encourage you to keep the conversation going. Seek out different perspectives and stay involved in shaping the future that you want to see. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.